All right, everybody, welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator, and our first guest today is Tibor McCann. He's a professor at the Argyros School of Business, if I pronounce that right.
That's correct.
And economics at Chapman University in Southern California. He's a research fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institute, and he writes for the Orange County Register, Mises.org, and StrikeTheRoot.com. He's the author of more than 20 books, including Marxism, A Bourgeois Critique, The Pseudoscience of B.F. Skinner, Neither Left Nor Right, The Passion for Liberty, Capitalism and Individualism, and most recently, Putting Humans First, Why We Are Nature's Favorite. Welcome to the show, Mr. McCann.
Thank you very much.
It's an honor to have you here. I wanted to have Paul Craig Roberts on for the first half hour and you for the second so we could have a good debate about free trade here, but he couldn't do it. So, I'm going to go ahead.
Besides, I know him. I don't know whether he wants to do that with me.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know about, you know, personality conflicts or anything.
No, I know him. I'm friendly with him. I don't have any problem with him.
Oh, there you go. Well, so it would have been a fun debate. But since he couldn't do the show, I'm going to go ahead and try my best to take his side of this argument so that we can finally hash this out and figure out what is the correct answer in the argument between free trade and protectionism. So, let's see, I guess I'll attempt to take Mr. Roberts' position here. He wrote a op-ed in the New York Times with Charles Schumer called, I forget the exact title, something about rethinking free trade or something. And the argument that he made goes something like this. Free trade is based on David Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage, but that this international trade theory is based on the idea that the means of production would stay put in its home country while the goods are exchanged. But that since the factors of production can move as easily as the goods, with all of today's modern technology and so forth, we are hearing what Ross Perot called the giant sucking sound, as not just blue but now white-collar jobs move overseas. And first of all, I'd like you to tell me what the hell I just said. What does that mean, and is that argument valid?
Well, you know, I don't argue in these terms. Paul Craig Roberts argues as an economist, especially as a macroeconomist. I argue as a moral and political philosopher. My concern is whether it is ever proper for the state to enter into any kind of a restrictive mode when it comes to people doing trade across borders. And I deny that. It is not the business of the state to prevent me from being able to buy stuff from abroad, from people from abroad buying stuff from me, including my labor. And if I want to go to Mexico and buy clothes there, I should be completely free to do that. That's what my freedom demands. Nobody has the right to go and protect farmers or textile workers or steel workers at the expense of my liberty. You see, that's the way I look at this matter.
Well, and I think he makes the argument in his column that, or maybe in one of his responses to somebody's criticism of his column, that on an individual level, that of course you're right, every individual is free to trade however they like, but in the more general sense, what is happening here is the destruction of America, that we're going to no longer be a sovereign nation, we're going to have, you know, basically a population of people who are either or very underemployed, and that we're going to end up losing everything.
Well, I don't know what he's talking about because there is no other than individual trade involved. When people get together, they're just a bunch of them together, but they're all individually consenting to make various deals with various people around the world who are also individuals. There are no collectives, there are no tribes, there are no clans, there are no nations in commerce. Commerce involves a bunch of people who are out to improve their lives through exchange. And I don't understand this talk about destruction of the nation, and I don't know what it means. I mean, free trade has been something that has been championed even before Adam Smith by some of the French economists as the means by which most efficiently to allocate resources. And as long as the state remains outside of this and merely acts as the upholder of contract and the defender of property rights, there should be absolutely nothing wrong with free trade, no matter how you look at it. The fact that some people don't win right away, that's like my going down this mall and deciding that instead of continuing my dealing with the Gap or with Macy's, I'm going to change my vendor to somebody else. Now, are you going to put a gun to my head and make me walk back to the same place where I did business last week because they've gotten used to me? Or are you going to allow me to do business elsewhere and the people who are maybe losing some of the business now have to look for a different job? This is no different from that at all.
Right, but I think the reason that people are so up in arms right now is because, I mean, frankly, the political class don't do blue-collar work. They do white-collar work, and they were getting paid good money for all those computer jobs and stuff in the 1990s, and now the white-collar jobs are flowing overseas along with the blue-collar jobs. When they were told to retrain and become software engineers, they did that, and now they lost their software engineer job. What are they supposed to retrain to do now?
Well, but you know, what are you going to do about it? Suppose that's the case, and I'm not even sure that's true. But suppose that's the case. What, are you going to hold somebody up and make them your little servant as your customer? I don't get it. I mean, what is the remedy that they're proposing for this? Whenever they want to propose a remedy, it usually means constraining someone's behavior against their own will, you know? And I don't go for that. Now, if I lose my job as a professor of philosophy because there are no students taking philosophy classes, I can't go out and round up a bunch of students at the point of a gun and order them to sit in my class and listen to me, you know? I'm very impatient with this idea that customers are supposed to accommodate people who need jobs. They should follow the market. They should make adjustments in their lives, just like we all have. If people don't want to read my columns or pay for them, I'm going to have to write something else, or I have to get out of the writing business. What's so new about this? This is what freedom means. And if you want to go overseas because overseas people are willing to do a job at lower wages than they are doing it here, that's really not all that different from my hiring a new babysitter who's willing to work for me at a lesser wage than the old babysitter. There's no difference there whatsoever.
Well, I definitely understand what you're saying on the individual level, but I think the hue and cry is about the nation losing all these jobs and that they're being replaced with, you know, just service jobs. And I think people are really concerned that it's, you know, it's going to be impossible to hold up a $9 trillion economy when everybody's a waitress or a cab driver and everybody does services for each other, but nobody really produces anything because it's all produced overseas.
Well, the fact is that America has in the past, because it was the only relatively free economy in the world, gotten fat and happy. But now other countries are catching on that maybe free markets are good, and so people are getting in and competing, and they're able to outbid American workers. That's the way life is.
So
maybe America doesn't deserve to continue at such a high level, high standard of living as it's gotten used to because other places were shut down. Now other people, and it's kind of like a team. Remember when the Americans had this fabulous basketball team that used to beat everybody in the world by 40 points called the Dream Team? And then other people started to learn how to play basketball. And the Dream Team no longer got away with beating people for 40 points. Detroit cannot collect all of the benefits, all the wages, making the same old kind of cars when there's Korean cars made by people who are not demanding that those kinds of benefits. You know, that's just common sense. I don't see, what do they want to do? What do they want to do? Do they want to shoot all the people who are willing to work for less so that they can keep their jobs?
Oh, no, I think they'd probably be promoting protective tariffs and...
Well, but that's basically doing that. That's saying to those people in Korea that you will not be able to work for the people we want to work for, and we're going to put up barriers for you to enter the market. I consider that to be morally repugnant.
Well, and really, it's a collectivist idea in the first place to have
it
a
is.
State, right?
But I mean, we're supposed to have commerce, the most peaceful international form of human behavior is now going to be intruded upon because some people gotten used to certain kinds of jobs and they're unwilling to reform and you know, adjust to the fact that they're losing their market. I mean, I don't understand this. This is an amazing thing for me, especially coming from someone who's a proponent of the free market. This is just, I mean, no wonder he went to bed with Schumer. Schumer was always a welfare statist, always a regulator, always somebody who believed in the petty tyranny of states. And now he's joining them. I don't know, out of maybe, maybe he's feeling badly for some workers, or maybe there is somebody in his family who's lost a job and has become a sentimentalist rather than a rationalist about this. But that's no excuse. I mean, it's no excuse when you lose something, say in a flood, to go next door and rob people to make up for it. I don't care how badly off you are, you must handle the thing in a civilized fashion without involving any coercion. And protectionism is coercion.
Okay, well, I know there's some communists, democratic socialists listening, who would say that, well, you know, you're obviously just a rich white guy who owns stuff and has employees, and you want the cheapest labor, and you don't care. And that,
but look, everybody wants it. Do you go to the grocery store looking for the highest price of the same good or the lowest price? Do you try to buy shoes, then you have two shoes. One of them costs $60 and the other one $45, and everything else is the same. I challenge anybody who's advocating this protectionism to showing this in their own personal lives, where they are not actually looking for better deals. Why is Walmart so successful? You know, because everybody wants to buy $160 Nikes, or because they want to buy cheap, you know, sneakers? I mean, who are all these people who are telling everybody else that they should go and buy expensive? And do they also want them to work for companies and not ask for the highest wage that they can get away with because they want to favor the shareholders? I mean, we are all trying to make good deals. That's our responsibility in life. My parents or my children or my friends or my relatives would be very angry with me if I went out the store and didn't come back with the best deal. That's my responsibility in life. Other people have to fend for themselves. Sometimes when we have friends and they are in dire straits or there is an emergency, then we contribute to charity, we give generously, and so on. But normally commerce is about making good deals for ourselves and for those we care about.
Well, and there are some people who say, you know what, I only drive Chevy because I buy American and I don't care if I can get a cheaper Nissan.
Well, that's fine with them. They can do that. It's their money. They're free to do whatever they want to do with their money, but they cannot come in with a gun and order me around what to do with mine. This is what protectionism is. It's not their behavior. It's imposing restrictions on other people's behavior. And I have never understood how come Americans, the leaders of the free world, they're not supposed to be communists and socialists. They're supposed to champion freedom of trade, open markets, no restrictions, no protectionism. And they're applauding things that Bush is doing for the farmers. And it's an embarrassment to have to stand up for America behind a president who's actually advocating totally un-American deals.
Yeah, well, he rescinded his steel tariff thing, right?
Yeah, he did. After a while, it was too embarrassing. And at the same time, you know, we are supposed to, before people elsewhere in the world picking up and getting going with their lives, and then we're shutting them out of the market, that's got a little bit too much, you know.
If we had the total, very limited constitutional republic, just the very basic rule of law, you know, I think a lot of your arguments make sense, but right now we live under this massive leviathan that has all sorts of subsidies and tax breaks and exemptions for big corporations. And
I oppose to them all, and I advocate constant removal of those things. I am not, you know, I am perfectly consistent. The fact is that the world is a mess, What are you going to do? Adjust to the mess? Forget about it. There is no way to accommodate in any principled fashion when people are unprincipled. If you have a crazy person who is one day acting toward you peacefully, the next day takes a gun, the third day breaks up your house, your furniture in your house, there is no way to handle this. You try to insist on a peaceful interaction with that person, and you never relent from that. And that's what I do. I am insisting on free trade, even in the midst of tariff wars and protectionism and subsidies, and whatever little influence I have, I might at least get people to think about how it would be to live in a world in which these barriers did not exist.
Well, and right now, isn't the government subsidizing companies to move overseas? I mean, that was a big thing in the 90s was, hey, if you move your factory to Indonesia and the locals attack it, don't worry, the government will bail you out, right?
Yeah, I understand that. But, I mean, you are not talking to somebody who advocated that.
Oh,
the government also the government also paid half the advertising bills of people advertising abroad.
Right. I mean, this is basically, you know, people who are promoting the protectionism, they're basically trying to pile more government on top of a problem that government is at least partly responsible for, not
exactly.
Just allowing free trade, but actually subsidizing companies to leave America.
Exactly. You know, the point is there is no principled policy that they have as an alternative. They are always doing Band-Aid work, you know, little patching here, little patching here, let's have some this and some that. And in the meantime, everything goes worse, and expenses increase, and people have less money to spend, and ultimately that means real job losses. No. The fact that America is outsourcing some of its manufacturing jobs simply means that other people are willing to perform those jobs at a lower cost, which is the most rational thing to do.
Well, the question is, who's going to buy their crap when none of us have any good jobs anymore? We can't afford to buy any of the stuff that the American companies are making overseas and trying to re-import.
I think that question reveals a rather cynical attitude about human beings, as if they couldn't adjust themselves to new circumstances, as if there was no innovation going on, as if there were no new gadgets and new ideas being bandied about in the marketplace all the time, which will generate jobs and work for people who may have lost jobs before. I mean, the fact is that right now in India, people are answering phones for American firms, but as Thomas Friedman pointed out in the New York Times the other day, they're using American computers to do that. And we haven't at all mentioned yet the biggest culprit. The fact is that most jobs are moving here because the draconian regulations that the government imposes, the draconian requirement that the government imposes on people to basically take care of everybody who happens to work for someone, the incredible workman comps bills that these people get, the tax bills that they get, and of course people are going to go abroad and say, Wendy, well, we'll find someplace else where we can manufacture our goods with less of this kind of albatrossian burden bugging us, you know.
Well, in America, traditionally was the tax haven for people to move their companies here.
But it is not anymore, because other people have learned, and we've gotten fat and complacent about this, and a whole bunch of people are holding out their hands, wanting the government to provide them with all kinds of benefits and security and all of that, and in the meantime, other people are getting to wake up to the fact that a vibrant economy is not one where the primary consideration is job security. I mean, look at Germany and France, where job security is their primary concern, and their unemployment rates are in the double digits, you know? Is that what America wants?
That's not what I want.
But that's what most protectionists are aiming for. I mean, this is kind of short-sighted thinking. This is like people who want to eat their cake and also have it sit there in the refrigerator waiting for them. You cannot have it both ways. You either have a robust economy in which people have to adjust to change, even if it's uncomfortable, or you have a stagnant economy in which in the end is going to end up like the Soviet Union and go bust.
Well, what do you know about the Soviet Union?
Well, I was born in Hungary, and I lived under Stalin's rule until 1953. And believe me, it was no picnic.
And you escaped from there, right?
I was smuggled out, yes.
Okay, well, speaking of short-sighted and far-sightedness, revolutionaries, whether they're poor, downtrodden masses or elitists, have this tactic they call pressure from above and below, the pincher strategy, where they get a bunch of people to argue for the position at the bottom, and then the people usually in government at the top say, oh, well, no problem, we have the solution. And it seems to me, I mean, usually I think of this in terms of socialists in the street demanding more government, and then government is more than happy to oblige. But I also worry that libertarian arguments provide pressure from below in a lot of cases. For example, NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, and coming up here, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, which is supposed to be completely ratified by next year, these are building blocks to world government. These aren't, I mean, they seem to be regulating in the direction of free trade, and yet they're really, what they are is bigger and bigger federal governments. And
well, they're a mixed bag. So far as they remove barriers to trade, they are not an accumulation of power. It's like repealing laws. Obviously, it has to be done from above, but it is done from pressure from below. If the certain kind of representatives get elected who are convinced that their constituency is not going to live with these regulations and these impositions any longer, they're going to remove them. That's like removing chains from slaves. Obviously, the removal has to be done by those who put the chains on them in the first place. So, yes, it's from above. But as long as it is a removal of impediments, a removal of restrictions, it does not build world government. It incapacitates world governments. World governments are only dangerous if they are imposing restrictions on human behavior. If all they do is uphold contracts and protect property rights, I don't care about world government or government in my city or anything. It doesn't make any difference to me. I think this whole idea of us versus them is an obsolete kind of thing that was appropriate when we were all in members of little tribes who believed that the only way of increasing one's wealth was to go out and rob other people. But if you realize that commerce is not a zero-sum game, but a win-win situation, then removing borders is of no consequence.
Well, you know, I can see the sort of Hoppian kind of dissolving of national borders as sovereignties become smaller and smaller, and you know, basically in a free trade manner of which you speak. But it seems like sovereignty is, instead of devolving, it's evolving into more and more centralization. And my fear is that when there's no more national borders left, it won't really be that there's no nation states. It'll be that there's one nation state, the whole earth, with one federal centralized government, one central bank, one standing army. And then at that point, we're all slaves. Don't expect them to protect your property rights then.
Well, first of all, it all depends. Obviously, it depends upon what particular philosophical outlook rules at the time, which is catching on, what the people who are still paying the bills for the bureaucrats and the politicians want from them. Unless we're dealing with a Stalin or a Hitler or a Saddam Hussein or an Ayatollah, we are talking about at least something that resembles representative government. Now, if it's something like representative government, then those who are being represented exert certain kind of influence. And I am trying to reach out to educate and persuade those who are ultimately sending their representatives to run these governments to tell those representatives, back off. That's your job. Your job is like a referee. It's supposed to keep the rules but not play the game. And if that gets if that line is in fact successful, if it makes headways, I don't care whether this is influential in Mount Ida, Ohio, or in the world. as far as I'm concerned, the real question is, are the laws protecting our rights or invading our rights? Where they come from, how large is the area over which they rule, that's a detail for me. I'm kind of a cosmopolitan. I don't believe in this, oh, we Californians must resist those Arizonians, and that we Alabamians, we must make sure that the Massachusetts, you know, this tribalism is the antithesis of the ideal that America put on record, namely that sovereignty lies with individuals, nobody else.
Well, but you don't worry that you might accidentally be helping to destroy America and replace it with a world state?
I don't even know what that means, destroy America. This, for me, the destruction of America means the destruction of the ideals of the Declaration of Independence. Suppose the world adopts those ideals and America as a unique place is destroyed because everybody is like America. That's what I am for.
Well, I understand.
I don't care about America as, you know, this continent that's completely artificial. I am interested in free men and women being able to live their lives. Whether they are on this continent or every continent is not of relevance to me.
Well, but this is why I bring up the pressure from above and below, because, you know, whatever the people in the street are demanding, or, you know, in your case, what you're writing in your papers, that's never quite what we get, you know, the argument. What we always get is the George Bush or Bill Clinton version. Not yours, you know.
I'm sure
if you had written the GATT Treaty, it wouldn't have been 57,000 pages long, but your argument helped get it passed.
I don't think so. That's you. I think you're wrong about that. My argument does not aid and abet people who want to promote protectionism. Never, because I never even give an inch to protectionism. I don't say freedom except here. I never say that. Freedom always. So you don't get me to aid and abet anybody who is for coercion. Just, I mean, it's true, there are people who are fraudulent. There are people who call something free trade that really isn't a free trade. And that's the task of those of us who are loyal to freedom as it really is supposed to be, the freedom of individuals to do with their lives as they see fit. They will have to bust this bubble of fraud, you know? And that's done all the time.
Let me get off of international trade specifically and just get to more just basic libertarian principles. You wrote an article not too long ago about minarchism versus anarchism.
Right.
And that split within libertarian factions. Now, I'm sure you're very familiar with the argument that you know, if you say that it's okay to have just enough government to protect your rights, that really you have to be endowing that government with enough power to confiscate people's property in order to protect it.
No, I don't. I have written extensively on how to fund government without one iota of taxation.
Oh, really?
A contract fee will do the job perfectly fine. Because the major instrument for establishing commercial relations in a free society is the contract, we don't know everybody personally, so we can't just rely on a handshake. We have to have a contract, and contract implies some sort of work being done, or at least some people being ready to do some work in a court of law, or maybe even in arresting someone who violates a contract and bringing him to justice and so on. There is a service charge for that, a fee for that. So whenever one enters into a contract, depending on its size and its scope, one has to pay a fee. That is perfectly enough to support a genuinely free society's legal order. That does not allow anybody with the authority to regulate anybody, to run public parks and beaches and all that crap that constitutes the massive state. That only introduces the one factor which would be introduced if you hired a private bodyguard and an arbitration agency to resolve disputes that you have with your neighbors. That's all that a person who believes in law and order requires. Now, you can call it government, you can call it a defense agency, you can call it whatever it is. That's just a bunch of words. The fact of the matter is that what you need is you need some referees who are specialists, who know how to act with due process, rather than trampling on people's rights in the process of trying to protect other people's rights. If you have this system, I think basically the difference between the anarcho-libertarians and the minarchist libertarians completely collapses. And that's what my argument is all about. And in fact, I wrote a big piece for this French libertarian journal where I say anarchism versus minarchism are rapprochement, you know, claiming that there's no difference between the two. There's just it's a phantom difference.
Right, because you still don't want there to be a monopoly on that power to decide.
But there is no monopoly. Look, when I suppose you buy an apartment house and you rent it out to people and they live in these apartments and after a while they don't pay and you want to throw them out. Are you acting as a kind of a coercive monopolist? No. You are the one who owns that apartment house. You have a monopoly in that apartment house, in that one. You don't have a monopoly in apartment houses. You have a monopoly in the one that you own. We all have monopoly in our particular bodies and times and so on. And that's the only sense in which there would be any kind of monopoly. The legal order that defends a certain region's rights, the rights of the citizens in a certain region, yes, operates in that order. But you can always go to another order. You can always move from a department store to another department store. You can't ask the other department store to come into the region of the first department store and start doing business there. And that's what these people want. They want a kind of a pizza delivery kind of conception of legal order. But that doesn't work. Because people who deliver legal services, including police services, prisons, courts, and so on, they have to be someplace. They have to be located someplace. And wherever they're located will be under their jurisdiction and not someone else's jurisdiction. And in that sense, they will be a monopoly, but they're not going to be an anti-competitive, coercive monopoly because you can go to another place. Just like even today, something resembling this already exists because if you don't like taxes in New York, you can move to New Jersey, they can't keep you there. There's always the exit option. And as long as you have the exit option, there is no monopoly. Or no insidious monopoly.
So what about the people who don't have a contract with the police department?
They don't get any service. Unless they interact with somebody, in which case they are subject to the law, because by their interaction they have made the commitment that they're going to respect people's rights. And if they fail to, they're going to have the law coming down on them. But that's, I am paying for that, just like I would be paying for a bodyguard. If you try to attack me, my bodyguard would defend me, and I would be paying his fees. Of course, the guy who is being arrested and put into jail may be made to make some license plates. I don't know.
What do you say to the leftist critics? I'm sure mostly on the left. In fact, I had a really great history teacher who was as libertarian as a socialist can be. who she taught us that, oh, the libertarianism, that's just the rich white man's anarchy. They just want to be able to own their factory and have nobody ever mess with them, pay their employees shit wages, slave wages, and have the police protect them from their slaves. But that's all.
Well, but I'll tell you what I tell people like that. One is that they are engaging in abominable arguments. They're not paying attention to arguments. They're calling people names. Now, if you want to call me somebody who lacks integrity, who does not really believe in the views that I hold, but simply hold them in order to give myself an excuse to be rich, well, first of all, it doesn't work because I'm not rich, okay? Second, it is an evasion of the debate, of the topic, to attribute a point of view to the motivation, a kind of a hidden agenda to the persons who put it forth, is to evade the argument. That's what Marx did when it came to Locke and Adam Smith, and that's what all of the Epigoni do. They keep dismissing an argument by bringing in the motivations of those people they don't even know, you know? These people don't know any libertarians. They never met any. Most libertarians are dirt poor.
Well, but you understand that the official version of history, as we all learn it in government school, is that the laissez-faire capitalists had their way for a century, and what they did was became evil monopolists, and thank goodness Franklin Roosevelt came and destroyed the company town, and that the reason that businessmen are so anti-government is because government gets in their way of doing whatever they want to.
But that's such crap, it's unbelievable. I can't even believe that you're saying this.
Yeah, well, I'm trying my best to be devil's advocate here. And
consider what you're saying. You were, about 10 minutes ago, you were telling me about how many people in business go in bed with government, ask for subsidies, ask for the government to rule out other competitors and so on, and now you're charging them with advocating laissez-faire capitalism. They don't. People in business are no different from artists, from educators, from whatever, actors or farmers. They want to get their little government subsidy just as much as anybody else. There is no class difference or professional group that is consistently in favor of either socialism or the welfare state or libertarianism. That's a matter of individual conviction, not a matter of what group you belong to. And to change the subject and focus on the fact that somebody is in business or that somebody is in farming or that somebody is in acting is not to respect the rules of argument. I can't argue with someone who basically dismisses me from the very beginning and says, I am arguing only because I am defending my vested interest. That basically rules me out of court. You understand?
Yes.
That makes me a sort of a lackey. And if that's what they want to call me, then let's not talk. You know? Because I have more, I have better things to do with my life than defend myself from people who are besmirching me, you know?
Right. Well,
and I know I come across this. I mean, I've been a university professor for 35 years, and believe me, there are people who do this to me, but I usually lay on them, and eventually they learn to get back to the subject matter of which is a better system, which has more justice in it, which produces more goods, which is fairer, and so on. Not about this, what sort of motivations lie behind it. I mean, most artists, for example, want to put their paintings on the wall because of their muse. They're not trying to serve humanity. They're not trying to be good to everybody. They have a vision, and they want to plaster the world with that vision. And so much the power to them, you know? I don't denounce them because they have a vision that they want to protect. People in business want to make money. That's what their business is about. People in medicine want to cure patients. What's the big deal? Everybody has a job and everybody has a task. And the question that we raise in political philosophy amongst socialists, libertarians, communists, welfare states, whatnot, is which sort of social organization or organization of human communities is going to facilitate the better achievement of human happiness? And the libertarians say a free one. And the socialists say no, an orchestrated one. And the communists say one that basically has brought up a bunch of people who automatically act like ants.
Well, I agree with you, by the way, but I just want to, I'm trying my best here to be the devil's advocate.
I understand. I'm just being rough on you, too.
Well, that's all right.
I'll be just as rough on you as if there were a devil there, right there. You know?
Well,
and you
fine.
Can
it
take it.
For,
you're in the business.
Oh, hell yeah. It makes for great radio. Well, as interesting as trade policy and stuff can be to the average folks driving around right now.
I understand.
okay, but, you know, what about the poor people? Because everybody knows that, you know, assume, you know, that the national government was at the most powerful, was limited to the Constitution, and we had an extremely free market, wildcat economy. Everybody knows that a few people are going to end up owning a bunch of big conglomerates and moving them all together, and they're going to destroy the middle class and make everybody...
Nobody poor. Knows that. That's
and
a myth.
Who's going to take care of the poor people?
That's a myth. First of all, the poor are evidently quite able to take care of themselves because every time there is a study of this, it turns out that the poor, on average, remain poor for 5 years, and then they become middle class, and some of them move on to become rich. the same thing the other way around, that in a genuinely free market atmosphere, the rich remain rich for so long, and then they, you know, like Kmart and the Sears and Enron and so on, their richness comes to a screeching halt. There is like a marathon race going on. Some people take over, run ahead, and then they fall back, and they go back and forth that way. There is no class of the poor. You know, that's a myth, the idea that there are these poor people who are always poor. Of those, there are very, very few, and they are probably people who are seriously damaged in some ways, who simply cannot make it in life in any case, and they depend on charity and generosity and not on government. Because government just makes everybody come in and volunteer up for being poor if it starts helping people. Otherwise, we should rely on the kindness of all of us to help those who are in genuine dire straits. Otherwise, the rest of us should just try to get along and produce and advance. And some of us don't want to. I mean, there are a lot of people who don't really particularly want to become very economically successful. They like to play their ukulele in the backyard and hang out with their friends and doodle, and anybody who would suggest for them to go and join a company and become wealthy are going to be rejected. So there's those people too. And most of I was poor. I lived in a Cleveland ghetto when I first came to this country. I lived there for about 2 or 3 years until I extricated myself and started on to a better life. But, you know, most of us start at some place. We have to start someplace. Some of us are very beautiful, and people will throw money at us. And so we are never poor. Some of us are very tall, and people will throw money at us in order to play basketball. Some of us are ugly, and we'll never get a date until somebody comes up and says that we have a good heart, and that's what they fall in love with. There's no one-size-fits-all social analysis that captures the diversity of the human condition.
Well, that's true, but what about, I mean, I'm thinking back in history, you know, they had these company towns where you load 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt, and the one company owns the property that you rent to live in, they own the store where you buy your food, and they organize it in such a way that you're always in debt and always getting deeper in debt. And that was the kind of thing that, you know, history shows that it was
Actually, history doesn't show anything. You keep saying this, history shows. History doesn't show that. History shows that the onset of capitalism saved lives by the millions. And that it wasn't easy, it wasn't without any kind of a pain, but that all in all, the people who benefited capitalism are far outnumbered the ones who suffered from it. Now, if you ask, do I know this? I know it by reading history books. And the historians I read, for example, if you want to get this topic discussed, get someone like Robert Hessen of the Hoover Institution, who has studied all this. In fact, he studied it so well that he convinced the late Sidney Hook that, in fact, the early times of capitalism were lifesavers for most workers.
So the company town thing was just a fluke?
Well, there were some company towns, but they were not operating on a pure capitalist basis. They were basically operating on the politicians being in the pockets of certain few powerful people. That's not capitalism. That's like a game in which one team owns the referees.
Sure, and then they come and pile more government on top of it as the solution from the federal.
Exactly. That's precisely what happens, and then they forget the fact that the distortions and the damage was caused by coercion in the first place.
All
right, I mean, it's sort of like I tend to be, because my discipline is political philosophy, I look at the very general principles. That's what I am supposed to be doing. That's the division of labor. Other people do individual studies. They look at historical factors and so on. My general point is that there is no proof whatsoever in any portion of history, in any element of morality, that coercion improves the human condition.
Well, maybe one person coercing someone from stopping coercing them.
That's not coercion. That's using force. Force is not the same thing as coercion. Coercion means force that violates people's rights. When you retaliate against a mugger, that's not coercion. That does involve force, or can involve force. Sometimes it involves being very cagey and savvy and dodging, and doesn't involve much force. Coercion means you use force to start a fight, so to speak.
And that's libertarian principle number one, to renounce coercion, right?
Exactly. That is the fundamental principle. And it's not all that, I mean, you know, people say libertarian. Look at the Declaration of Independence. It says we have unalienable rights to a life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it says that governments are instituted to secure these rights. That's libertarian. Libertarianism is taking this to its various myriad of implications and laying them out and honing them, but that's all it is. The Declaration has it all in it in a sketchy fashion.
Well, that must be what's thrown everybody off course so much, is they're not used to people having a single principle and sticking by it and applying it in all situations.
Exactly, but then look,
they're so confused.
And why would that be such a strange thing? After all, when you study any discipline, whether it's engineering or chemistry and so on, you go to school in order to learn the general principles, and then you go out and apply them in the various details and the particular areas and the specialties. But you need general principles, and whether it's in physics or chemistry or biology or psychology or whatnot, because you're dealing with things of a certain kind that are similar. And in order to be able to understand those things, you have to learn its essence, the basic nature of those things. On those things, they are all the same. Human beings all are thinking animals. That's one thing from which certain principles follow. And one of the principles that follows from that is that they need to be free to do their thinking.
If you don't mind, I'd like to switch gears here and talk a little bit about foreign policy.
Well, that's fine. Go ahead.
I want to talk about war, I guess, is what I mean, rather than just the trade thing. There's a whole set of libertarians, and hopefully it's the minority, but particularly the Ayn Rand faction of libertarians tend to support this idea of libervention, that we need to use force in order to liberate the world so that then they will have free markets and democracy like us and everything will be fine.
I thought you're talking about libertarians. These sound like neoconservatives to me.
Well, that's what it sounds like to me too, but,
yeah, but they're
I'm
not
reading
I mean,
it off the Ayn Rand fan club side or whatever, you know.
Look, Ayn Rand is dead. Let's leave her out of the picture. We don't know what she would have done about Iraq. I contend that Ayn Rand is only in support of defensive force and would have never sanctioned the United States intervening anywhere in the Balkans or in the Middle East or anywhere. Because when soldiers sign up, volunteer for the U.S. military, what they take an oath to do is to defend the Constitution, to defend individual rights of the citizens who hired them, not to go out on all kinds of scouting missions. Let's look for a war we can fight. What kind of nonsense is that anyway?
Well, it's successful nonsense. It's the nonsense that carries the day now.
Well, it carries the day, but, you know, let's wait until the end of this year and see if Bush is going to ride high then. With this this war that, I mean, the fact that he destroyed Saddam Hussein, do you know how many others like Saddam Hussein there are? Are we going to take the United States military to all of these regions of the world and beat up on these guys?
Hey, be careful what you ask for. We'll be invading southern Africa day after tomorrow.
I know. I mean, you know, I used to, when back in the Nicaraguan days, and when they were all upset about Ali North, I always imagined, what if Jesse Jackson had been president and there had been a chance for him to sell some stuff to Iran and get some support for the African National Congress, and he would have gotten a medal for that.
Yeah, right. But they were anti-Sandinista, so no medal.
Yeah, that's of course, because the left always screams about freedom and preemptiveness when it's their own people who are getting beaten up. I mean, the left wing is the most preemptive statist group ever. All government regulation is preemptive. Something might happen, so we are going to impose draconian laws everywhere. That's preemptive legal policy.
So and what now to doing a sort of international gun control.
Exactly. Exactly. So they should be applauding this. This is a left wing policy.
That's what I said from the beginning, was they were just mad about Iraq because they were jealous that they didn't get to go and install democracy over there.
The left wing is so inconsistent. I mean, the fact, and it started back in the McCarthy era, where they were all bent out of shape about McCarthy going overboard with his ranting and raving against communists, but they never paid attention to Stalin, you know?
Right. And then it,
I mean, they hate McCarthy more than they ever stated that this butcher of 20 million human beings was getting a free hand from them, while McCarthy, this two-bit politician maniac, was the villain, you know? This is typical leftist thinking.
And, of course, it's funny, as a footnote here, to add that it turned out that McCarthy was right, and all the people that he named on his list, when the Russians opened their the Venona files or Verona files,
yeah,
or something, it turned out that they were all communists, just like he said. They were working for the Russians.
It was such a little bit going overboard, because actually McCarthy didn't have that evidence. He imputed it, but he didn't have it.
Oh, well, he had a list of names that he got from the FBI, I thought.
Well, I'm not a historian about that, so I'll bail out of this discussion.
Well,
but if you want to talk,
I got a great segue. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were created at Bretton Woods in 1945 by one of these communists, a guy named Harry Dexter White, who it turns out was an AGP agent.
I mean, that's, you know, all of these organizations are highly tainted and mixed, and some of them, like right now, the World Bank and the Monetary Fund are being a little bit more leaning in the direction of making people behave, in the sense of you don't give easy credit to people who can't pay it back, you have to balance your budget, and so on. But that's recent. You know, that's just like in the last couple of years, and they can change their minds anytime because they are very receptive to the input of political experts from Harvard and Princeton, you know.
Right. All right. Well, you got any closing comments? We're about on our hour here.
Well, I'd just like to say that it'd be kind of a nice thing if America got back to the ideals that made it a distinctive society to which millions and millions of people flock, not because of the welfare state, not because of subsidies, not because of protectionism, but because here they could do something on their own and they would get the respect that that deserves for them, not because they belong to some class or some tribe or some ethnic group or something. Now, we have never completely lived up to these ideals, that's true, but it is true that America was the one political community where these ideals at least were announced and declared to be right.
Hear, hear.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. Everybody, Tibor McCann is a professor at the R.G. Russ School of Business and Economics at Chapman University. He writes for the Orange County Register, Mises.org, and StrikeTheRoot.com. He's the author of tons of books, more than 20, and the latest one being Putting Humans First, Why We Are Nature's Favorite. Thanks again for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Very welcome. Bye-bye.